Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is the Ocean Protect podcast, talking about the issues that face our oceans and what we can do about it. Presented by Ocean Protect, committed to change.
Shannon Mead, welcome to the Ocean Protect podcast.
Thanks for having me again. Third time round. Third time's a charm.
I know. And look, you're in rare air because it's only yourself and the legendary Graham Lloyd from Sea Shepherd Australia who have appeared on the podcast three times. So you must be doing something right.
I'll have to have a chat to him about that. I didn't realise that, but now we can make it a competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you keep on doing amazing work. And it has to be said, if I backtrack a little bit, we have obviously met a few years ago at the Litter Congress, I believe, in Sydney, where you wowed the masses with a fantastic talk around cigarette butts, blew everyone's mind. And I'll get you to sort of recap just on some of the truth bombs about cigarette butts that we love talking about. But there's been a lot of action in the space of cigarette butts. And you're obviously Chief Butt Officer at No More Butts. And I know you've been hightailing around the countryside doing all things international plastic treaties. So we're keen to dive into that. What I thought we might actually dive into first is just for the uninitiated, can you give us some quality truth bombs around cigarette butts and how they're linked to plastic pollution?
Happy to do that. And I think the most important thing is that they are plastic pollution. A lot of people still don't realize that cigarette butts are plastic. The tobacco filters are plastic. They're a cellulose acetate, and globally there's 6 trillion plus which are produced and consumed each year, and they estimate globally 4.5 trillion make it into the environment. When we look at Australia, that's 8.9 billion. That's about 18 months ago. It seems like consumption rates have come down in line with vaping, and we can talk about that as well. But as population rates have increased, even though percentages are dropping, it's still going to be there or thereabouts. And I think, as I said at that, the Volvo Ocean Lovers Festival, whether it's 8.9 billion or 6 billion or 7 billion, it's just too many plastic butts in our environment. That's our key focus, is to make sure that they're not in our environment, do everything that we can. And that started off as a individual impact, cleaning up butts. And then now, as you say, it's sort of escalated as far upstream as we can go. And in this case, up to the plastic treaty being debated at an international level at the moment.
It still is a fact that I think doesn't resonate with a lot of people, is that cigarette butts are plastic. And even came as a real surprise to me. Like, you look at the filter and a lot of people think, and I'm not a smoker, but there's a sort of assumption held by many, unless you're tuning into this amazing podcast and listen to the truth bombs that Shannon drops, that cigarette butts are paper. It's just a bit of cotton and a bit of paper, but that's not true, is it?
No, it's not. So it's tens of thousands of fibrous strands known as cellulose acetate. And essentially what they're wrapped in, this paper, this tipping paper, obviously the tobacco's, you know, thrown in there and so on. And people use this single-use plastic. And let's face it, it is a single-use plastic. They use that filter to consume their cigarette. And once they're done with it, unfortunately, in up to 50% of the cases, they throw that into the environment. So yeah, it's a plastic. It can persist in nature up to 15 years. You've got varying degrees, whether it's 8, 9, 12, 14, but up to 15 years, depending on the conditions. And so if you can imagine 15 years of accumulated cigarette butts all in one place together in this giant ashtray, just imagine that for a second. That would be horrendous. But that's realistically, we've scattered that throughout our environment.
It's mind-blowing. It really is. And you forget about the fact that they're a filter. So they're really good at absorbing various pollutants. So it's not just the fact that it's made of plastic. It's the fact that it's a very absorbent plastic that can absorb a whole bunch of nasties in our marine or waterway environment. And if there's an unsuspecting seagull or seabird or some other sort of marine creature that accidentally gobbles it down, they're not going to feel too good, are they?
No, definitely not. And there's actually a really good 1 minute micro, because they had actually done, a cigarette through a bottle and through cotton wool. And everyone's like, oh, but that's cotton wool, you know, do something different. They did it with a piece of bread, and just instantaneously all the chemicals and everything which were absorbed into that piece of bread. So you can imagine then somebody, a seagull, using that as a food source. That's pretty crazy. And realistically, that the cellulose acetate filter is no different. So when it's sitting in our marine environment and it's got all of those toxins that it's captured from the cigarette, that can be, you know, digested, eaten, released into the food stream. Not to mention the microplastics which are created, all these little fibers which are created as they break down across that 15-year journey.
I've actually gone down the rabbit hole of whether the filters on cigarette butts are actually a good thing or even necessary at all. It's an incredible story. We've touched on this briefly on our previous chats, and it's almost been a throwaway comment, which I think you've made, and we haven't really delved into the detail. So I'm keen to do that now, is the fact that the filters on cigarette butts serve no significant health benefit. In fact, they're probably making the health impacts of smoking worse, in addition to all the environmental dramas that they have. Can you give people a bit of a potted summary around, I guess, why we have cigarette filters in the first place and how they're actually not as good as people might think?
It was a crazy realization for me as well. I'm an ex-smoker. I had hoped or assumed that, of course, this filter does its job and filters out all these nasty particulates from entering into me. From an environmental perspective, we were taking this from we don't want that damaging our environment. But then there was always this question I was posing, you know, are they a single-use plastic? And if so, what's required in order to remove them under single-use plastic directives, you know, state-based, national, whatever? And so it was interesting that last year, the World Health Organization said, there's no evidence they provide benefit to human health. So I thought that was quite interesting. And then, as you mentioned, we've dug further, and just only last month or the month before, the Belgian Superior Health Council has come out to actually say, not only is there no evidence they provide benefit, but actually there's concern that they cause harm. And that could be via the filtration methods in itself, sort of actually, you know, breathing in or sucking in harder because of the filtration and the holes in the filters. And then you've obviously got the microplastic fibers. So the fact that these are the cellulose acetate fibers, you can actually be inhaling those and ingesting those into your lungs. So, you know, does it potentially filter out some of the particulates and nasties? I'm sure that it absolutely would. But it's not solving the problem. It's not providing any human health benefit from you. It's not weeding out cancer. And if we reflect back to the 1920s and 1930s, before filters were introduced, people were just smoking tobacco. They had their rolling pouches. You remember Audrey Hepburn with her lovely tobacco stick smoking her cigarettes. And that's what it was. And tobacco filters were introduced as a way for tobacco not only to save money on tobacco leaf, the generation of tobacco leaf, all of a sudden just throw a bit of plastic in there and it's much cheaper, but also they're able to do things like, you know, menthol filters and these capsule filters and introduce flavors and textures into tobacco. So I think it came about at the time where people were starting to worry about health and going, oh, filter, that sounds fantastic. It's like a water filter. Clearly it's filtering out all the nasties. But in fact, it doesn't look like it serves any genuine purpose.
That is staggering. I must admit, wandering around town, the rates of smoking have clearly decreased. And obviously, people are smoking less, but vaping substantially more, I think, as a general rule. Are you seeing the change in littering rates in your sort of cleanups and other sort of data analyses that I'm guessing you look at within Australia?
They're still the most littered item. So yes, there's a decrease, but kind of as I mentioned at the start, population is increasing. Smokers' percentages are decreasing and smoking rates are decreasing. You actually look at population growth and it kind of nets out about the same. So they're still the most littered item that we are seeing. People are augmenting their smoking with vaping. So they're doing both. And then obviously we've got a brand new generation now, which is starting to vape. And we can talk about the issues of, you know, environmental issues about vaping as well. So I'd say vaping is not a silver bullet for health or environment. I'll let the health people debate whether or not it's better for you or, you know, better than the alternative. There will still be cigarette butts that exist, which we need to work out how to deal with.
And look, I guess the other sort of change is I have seen, and it, you know, comes out of the investigations by the Belgian, is it Superior Health Council and others? I think there was But I've seen an article you referred to from the Netherlands as well. Like, there's a real strong push to banning the filters within cigarette butts. And obviously we've seen this movement in New Zealand around, you know, generational ban on cigarettes in general. But so we are seeing a lot of increased attention, awareness around the issue and some pretty heavy-handed techniques around solving it, if I'm blatantly honest, like complete bans.
Absolutely. I think, you know, when we first met, my closing slide in that very first session in the Leader Congress was, are cigarette butts a single-use plastic? And, you know, I thought, oh, wow, that's a very controversial thought for me or for the industry to have, as in the environmental industry. But it seems that, you know, we were asking the question at the right time. And it's not just, of course, because of our question, but lots of countries, lots of environmental bodies, but more importantly, combination of environment and health coming together and discussing and agreeing, because we've been taking this environmental approach and then health has been talking about a health approach, but very rarely has the environment said to health, hey, you know what, can you do this study for me? I just want to know. And how cool would it be in Australia if we actually had that similar thing? How cool would it be if Butler was asked by Plibersek to go and do a study on whether or not the filters made a difference for Australian smokers and report on that, and we can make an informed decision in the future for us?
You touched on coming together. There was a big get-together just recently in Paris called INC2. Oh, yeah, we. And you were in the mix of it. I'm guessing between, you know, croissants, visiting Jim Morrison's grave, Arc de Triomphe, you know, Eiffel Tower at night with the glittering lights, there was a whole bunch of shenanigans around plastic pollution. So for those who aren't familiar with the INC2, what is it, first up?
It's the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee. So I keep on referring to it as the International Negotiating Committee, but it is an important difference because it is member state driven. It's not NGO driven, civil society driven. But it's basically, people might have heard of this treaty to end plastic pollution, or the official term is the legally binding instrument to end plastic pollution. What that's trying to do is, between now and the end of 2024, all member states have agreed that we should have a treaty which will end plastic pollution. Now, what we have to do is discuss and debate over the next, you know, year and a half until that conclusion is, what does that actually mean? And what control measures, implementation measures, and objectives should that actually serve? Is that restricting new production? Is that limiting consumption? Is it removing plastics and polymers and chemicals of concern? Is it dealing with legacy waste? Is it introducing a safe circular economy? So all of these different opinions, if you can imagine 170-ish countries trying to agree on that in the next year and a half, that's essentially what INC is.
It is amazing. And we did have Tom Gammage on last year around the Global Plastics Treaty and the meeting, I think, that was held in Nairobi, I believe, previously. So is this the second time this sort of collective group of individuals and, I guess, organizations have got together? But you touched on all these countries. So who actually was there?
Almost all the member states. I think there was 169 officially registered, but that's because some of the EU countries, for example, that in this context they were actually speaking on behalf of. So they probably turned up, sat in their seat, grabbed a croissant and headed home. Let's say all countries in the world were represented or in attendance to a certain degree. And then you've got all of these different bodies, and we fall under, you know, civil society organization as a NGO, a non-governmental organization. There's industry there. There's, you know, presence from youth and children, there's presence from Indigenous peoples. So all of these kind of categorizations and subcategories, you need to be an accredited observer. We are lucky enough that we applied and received that status in advance of INC2. And so that's pretty much who's involved. It's the who's who of everyone from government through to industry, through to NGOs, science, research, Engineers Australia were there as well. Bit of a melting pot, and interesting to hear the diverse views and opinions.
I'm sure there's a diverse range of opinions. And I'm guessing you touched on industry, but just to clarify, were the plastic producers there as well? So petrochemical industries, you know, the Coca-Colas of the world, the Nestles, et cetera?
Yeah, generally represented by their peak bodies and their, you know, alliances for, you know, a robust treaty discussion. So in general, it seems that they're committed to agreeing to the mandate and committed to, you know, mandatory targets. But what does that look like? And of course, saying that as a responsible company on the global stage is an important thing, is an important lens to see. But then you might see different actions from countries that produce oil that creates plastic, which are maybe not as, don't have the same level as ambition or high ambition that some of the other countries have.
I don't get to go to cool places like Paris as part of my job, Shannon, so very jealous. But I think it's about as exotic as I get as Ballarat or Ipswich. Paint a picture. So you've got all these people from all different cultures, countries. I'm guessing there's a sort of a main forum. I'm guessing there's backroom discussions. I'm guessing the likes of Coca-Cola or Big Tobacco, for example, are looking at you with your No More Butts t-shirt. Don't like that guy. I'm not going to sit next to him at lunch, you know, for example. Give me an idea of just what it feels and looks like.
Pretty awe-inspiring or mind-blowing when you walk in. So the plenary hall, and bear in mind, this was a venue smaller than could actually cater for all attendees. And there was this big sort of drama beforehand because it didn't look like there would be enough passes for everyone who wanted to attend into this venue.
Oh, really? The Willy Wonka's golden ticket to the factory.
Pretty much. And they had all of these rotating badges, and you know, you could have two on the first day but only one on the second day, but then you could register here. And so it was there was a lot of feedback around that, and hopefully they've taken that on notice and looking at larger venues in the future. The positive is that it shows there's lots of interest and intent from everyone to get this thing right, but it also could mean that there's lots of seats sort of stolen or occupied, which people may not have or may not be there to facilitate or negotiate in the best interest. Let's just imagine you walk in, you've got hundreds of seats downstairs, and basically you've got this area for 2 to 4 delegates from every country in the world. And you've got, you know, all the mics and all the screens and all the you know, the flags and the placards and so on. And so it's alphabetically arranged, you know, it's literally as you'd find it or imagine it in any movie. If you were planning to make an intervention, which anyone could sign up for, but, you know, few and far between spots, you could sort of sit in the back 2 rows and you know, find your way to a microphone and make the intervention at the right time. But most people sat upstairs, and it's just like going to the National Theatre or whatever, you know, the Civic Theatre in Ballarat.
I'm not sure if it's the same, but we'll move on.
Where you've got the dress circle where we're basically observers, including ourselves, we're able to sit there and watch it and then pop downstairs for a stale baguette occasionally. Yeah, the setup was pretty amazing. You know, interpretations, like you're thinking about interpreting from hundreds of or dozens and dozens of languages back into, you know, 4 or 5 main languages, and everyone's got their interpretation set. So like your headset, and I could press the button to change to Espanol or French or back to English. So that in itself, first time attendee was, wow, this is big. This is the real deal. Like everyone, we were there to listen to topics and discussions and arguments, even of topics of substance. And unfortunately, we ended up with about 2 or 2.5 days worth of just procedural matters, which we couldn't get past. So that was a bit frustrating, but we got there in the end.
So 2.5 days of just arguing about procedural matters as opposed to the real crux of, hey, what are we going to do about solving the plastic pollution crisis?
Yeah, basically. So the Secretariat had prepared this discussion paper, this issues document, which, you know, observers and countries from around the world provided input into beforehand. And that was things like, you know, what should it include, or what statements most resonate with what you want to see in the treaty eventually. So that's what we all thought that we'd be doing. But, you know, that's quite naive. And, you know, it was actually about saying, well, no, we haven't elected the Bureau yet. Cool, let's elect the Bureau. Well, we haven't decided how to vote yet. Well, actually, yeah, we have. No, we haven't. Yes, we have. No, we haven't. It was literally interventions from countries saying, I agree, I stand with this country. No, we haven't. Someone else jumps in. I disagree. I stand with this country. We have. So that took about 2.5 days.
Wow.
To elect 2 remaining Bureau members. And then there was this discussion about what they're calling bracketed text around voting mechanisms and so on. And ultimately, that there is a real risk that a lot of people don't believe they're operating under the draft procedure, you know, the draft terms of process, which means that we could get to the end and they go, no, 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 hang on a sec, it's got to be consensus, not majority vote. And the whole thing has possibility of you know, not getting through.
2.5 days of, if I'm honest, sounds pretty unexciting. So you're all G'd up to solve the plastic pollution crisis, you and hundreds of other people, and you're having to sit through tedium discussions around boating methods and bureaus and all that sort of stuff. But obviously after the 2.5 days, you're probably low on energy, but I'm guessing it improves from there?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it was Mexico that sort of stood up and just said, look, let's just stop delaying. We're here to negotiate. Let's go. And everyone stood up and clapped and broke into their contact groups, the two contact groups which were planned. But of course, we got called back into the hall saying, yeah, we didn't follow process. We're supposed to call it closed, gavel. Okay, now you can go.
Oh, dear.
I felt like tacos that night, I can tell you what, go Mexico. I think so. Basically, what happened is then, you know, from late on Wednesday through to late on Friday, these two contact groups where pretty much the delegates were split into two. So if they had four delegates, you know, two in each room, and they would discuss topics of substance. So things like, you know, how do you determine the criteria for a problematic plastic, which is something we're keen on. What does a non-toxic circular economy look like? What is a just transition for the informal waste picking section look like? So all these really important topics, which, you know, when you and I go and put our plastic bottle out in our bin on a, you know, Tuesday night for recycling, we don't think about all of these, you know, upstream issues and all of these impacts. So it was really eye-opening to kind of be part of all of those elements.
So how long did that, like, obviously 2.5 days of bureaucratic, you know, boringness, but how long was the rest of the discussions?
The remaining 2.5 days. So it was 5 days, 5-day event on the calendar.
Oh, right.
And ultimately, the intention or the hope from everyone is that there would be a mandate for the zero draft. And, you know, to me, I'm like, what is a mandate? Does that mean I'm going to catch up with my mate for a beer? Or? And I was trying to work out also, what's a zero draft? Surely there's a first draft. And a mandate for a zero draft means, yes, we should do first cut off this thing. It gets to the stage where everyone's like, you know what, we've debated everything of substance, even though there's different viewpoints, that can now be wrapped up into the text which forms the base of the first cut of the plastics treaty. So we got that about 8:30 p.m. local time on the Friday night after the 5 days, and that's ultimately what everyone was there for. Right. We didn't expect anything more. We hoped for nothing less. So the fact that we got that is obviously the right outcome. It just felt like it took a long time to get there and probably delayed a lot of the discussions that could have taken place.
What does this physically mean to the global population and plastic pollution?
So basically from here is there's going to be the INC3, which is Nairobi in November. And just yesterday, the Secretariat's released basically a draft or a template for member states and accredited observers to provide their feedback on elements that weren't discussed in the first 5 days of INC3, plus also feedback on intersessional groups to progress topics that need to be addressed to be incorporated into the text. Basically what it means is before INC3, we'll get a draft. It's like, you know, you get your first draft of the contract, whether that's an employment contract or whatever it is, and have the opportunity to review that and say whether or not it captured the intent and tone of INC2. And then from there, it's a question of debating and negotiating those terms. So what does it fundamentally mean? Is there a time frame? Is it the elimination of all new plastic production by a certain date? Is it all new unnecessary plastic production? Is it the creation of new polymers? So all these terms and technicalities basically now need to be negotiated with the intention by the end of the fifth session in Korea at the end of next year that countries agree and sign off on this, you know, treaty to end plastic pollution.
So by next year, if all things go well, there will be a signed final treaty around ending plastic pollution.
That's the intention.
That sounds pretty positive. Like, obviously, 5 days of 2.5 days of fluffing around and 2.5 days of some, you know, decent negotiations and discussions. So, that what came out of this was just basically a draft contract or a draft treaty. Oh, no, so recognizing this is a draft treaty, but what are the key sort of features that, you know, Joe Public can sort of look towards maybe seeing finalized next year?
It'll be, I think, for Joe Public, it'll be around production and consumption. So, on a global level, what are the products that don't need to be plastic and can be replaced? Or in our sense, what are the products which are plastic and don't even need to be replaced, like tobacco filters? I think when we relate it back to Australia and a state level, all of these disjointed or fragmented single-use plastic bans, you know, straw here, takeaway container here and so on, we're not only pushing for harmonisation at a national level, but this is actually at an international level. So what we're doing is saying it's unacceptable to produce any more of X, Y and Z product or polymer to create product. It's, you know, unacceptable to produce more than this level to ensure sustainable consumption of other products which might be required necessary. And then when you talk about circular economy, making sure that what you're putting into a circular economy is only what you need to and is toxic free. So we're not just talking about throwing every plastic bottle into circular economy. Do you need the plastic bottle in the first place? If not, design it out. If you do, then what's the quality of that to make sure that it can exist in a circular economy for as long as possible at its highest value? Then there's talk about, you know, legacy waste. How do you deal with legacy waste? How do you deal with issues like, you know, fishing nets, which I know is a huge topic, like ghost gear? How do you deal with even legacy cigarette butts? How do you deal with straws and drink bottles and the Pacific garbage patch? Like, what are the mechanisms to deal with that and who pays for that? So it's all encompassing.
Are those things, like, obviously they're sort of high level ideas around what could be done. What is actually in the draft treaty? Are we saying it is likely that we're going to see a basically progressive ban of single-use plastics globally? Are we likely to see commitments around removing that legacy pollution? For example, cigarette butts, are they just likely to be mandated out come next year? Is there some key actions that are likely to occur at the end of next year based on the draft treaty as it is?
I think the agreements are due by the end of next year. The implementation plan, I guess, is the next thing. And this is where countries have very different perspectives on whether it's a voluntary implementation plan or whether it's mandated and regulated and compulsory. And there's obviously difference of opinion on that as to whether they produce plastic or are affected by plastic. So obviously, small island developing states are really impacted by plastic. You've got some which rely on these disposable alternatives because of the economy. Like if you look at Philippines, you can't afford to buy a large bottle, so you buy a sachet. So you've got to make sure that if you do a transition, you're not negatively impacting them and removing something from them. In real sense, by the end of 2024, the idea is that all countries have agreed on those key steps as to what will define the future of plastic, you know, design, production, use, consumption, and end-of-life management for implementation by a target of 2040. It's just a question of whether or not that's a mandated target or a soft target.
So did you walk away from the Paris shenanigans feeling optimistic, positive about the experience and where we're going, or a bit like, oh God, it's just not happening?
My reflections were an amazing event to be part of, to at least gain insight into what happens. I think, you know, the discussions that we have, whether it be at a state or a federal level, and, you know, the intent and the, you know, the handshakes and lip service and so on, it's like, this is where the rubber is hopefully going to hit the road. So it was really great to be part of that. Yes, there was positive momentum to end up with this, you know, mandate for the zero draft. But realistically, we've still got, you know, 1.5 years before we actually get to the conclusion of that. So there are multiple things that could derail it. I guess I'm cautiously optimistic, certainly not negative or pessimistic about it, but I'm not walking out high-fiving everyone saying, like, wasn't that the most amazing experience? So, but that was probably because the stale beer.
But in all honesty, it's an incredible achievement to get that many nations and groups focusing on this issue, which we know is a critically important issue to the health of the planet and ultimately humanity. And obviously to get various stakeholders involved, not just the tree-hugging, man-bun-wearing vegan hippies of the world, but dare I say, the plastic producing representative groups. And I'm sure as much as they are part of the problem, I'm sure they recognize they're part of the solution as well. And they are a key stakeholder in this. You know, what they prefer or say has a significant impact on the future of such a treaty. And it's really interesting, that perspective. You mentioned the Philippines around, you know, some people just can't afford to buy things with a, in a large container or plastic free. And equally, like you touched on I remember in one of the articles I've seen you refer to the waste pickers. You know, if for example, plastic is stopped being produced and we all of a sudden don't have a whole bunch of plastic waste, we do need to consider that transition of all the waste pickers. What are they going to do with their recognizing that their livelihoods are very much dependent on picking through waste? Whilst that might be a very, very average job, and I'm sure it is, what did they do if all of a sudden there's no plastic waste? So there's a lot to consider, a lot of stakeholders, a lot of different opinions, a lot of perspectives, and a lot of commercial interests involved.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Absolutely. And I think the chair and the secretariat did a pretty good job at trying to navigate through all those conversations in amidst all this, you know, geopolitical concern. Like when you've got countries or delegates from countries like Russia and Ukraine intervening on each other's comments to do with this topic, you realize this is not just about this topic. It's also about conversations in general. And then when you have, you know, sort of China and India and Brazil sort of also making comment, and then you've got the US sort of weighing in, EU independently. I think my assessment of Australia's involvement as well was the delegation probably spoke when they needed to speak to and spoke quite well. I think in an overall sense, the high ambition coalition, which Australia is a member of, probably wasn't pushing as hard or as high in these first forums. Hopefully that comes in the more negotiation stage after the draft text is done. But certainly the delegation did quite well. And one of the Australian delegates co-chaired one of the contact groups. So it was, you know, I think they were there flying the flag. New Zealand did actually fantastically well, I think, spoke really well. Lots of connection back to Indigenous knowledge holders, landowners, and how to learn from them. So there was lots of really salient points. That was really great to hear some of that. And then all of a sudden, it's, you know, an intervention about a procedural matter again. It's like, oh.
I'm just curious to know the dynamics of the room as well. Like, and obviously there's the formal proceedings. I'm guessing there's sort of, you know, catch-ups when you're eating your stale baguette offline. Like you're there with big tobacco. You mentioned Russia and Ukraine, you know, having discussions around this, and obviously various countries that, let's face it, don't often get along. And obviously varying levels of prosperity. For example, is there rich nations looking at the poorer nations saying, you guys have got to clean up your act, or are poor nations looking at rich nations going, well, you guys are still, you know, heavily polluting on the climate change front? You know, like, I'm just curious to know what the dynamics are like, really. Like, for example, big tobacco, they see you walking around with your No More Butts t-shirt. Do you go over and say hello and say, hey, how are you?
No, and I don't think they had any representatives directly. And probably just to clarify, and I know this is not what you meant, but when you said, when I'm there with big tobacco, let me be really clear. They're with big tobacco. They've got interest, obviously, in like International Chamber of Commerce, you know, those kind of groups who did have representation there, because they obviously are restricted by the Framework Convention of Tobacco Control. Most of those member states wouldn't be allowed to engage with them. So I'm not aware of anyone from tobacco that was in attendance. Certainly not, you know, directly in attendance. I think for them, does it matter? Possibly. Is it first thing on their priority list at the moment? Probably not. You know, they're focused on creating this new smoke-free, you know, vaping kind of future and whatever else. They've got their own plastic reduction targets. They've probably got biodegradable filters in tow. So it's an interesting thing. But everyone was civil. I'd say that. Even the conversations that you just knew there was frustration and it was at boiling point, it was all civil. You'd see really passionate, young, enthusiastic environmentalists, like, you know, youth that would approach some of these countries that were holding it up. But it was all very can I talk to you about this? Can you help me understand this? And it was done with a level of, I guess, integrity and maturity, which I guess you'd expect or hope. No doubt they probably went back to the hotel room and, you know, had a bit of a bitch session over a glass of vino. But no, I think in public it was all well managed.
That sounds fantastic. Really impressive, to be honest. Like, where to from here? So you've come back from Paris, and I'm sure everyone's sort of gone back to their home countries, but there is plans to get together again.
Yeah. So from the overall INC process, it leads into INC3. So by the middle of August, submissions for these sort of statements of what should be taking place in intersessional groups and was anything missed out, so that they can be incorporated into the draft text. Then we'll likely see the draft text INC3 Nairobi in November. Everyone will work out if they want to attend, if it's going to be valuable to attend. Then INC4 will be in Ottawa, Canada, I think March timeframe. And then the final INC will be in Korea next year. So there's sort of stages and progress. If I look at specifically what is important for us, you know, we've got these intersessional groups. One of these recommendations is that they start to look at the criteria for problematic and avoidable polymers and plastic products of concern. And to me, that's where tobacco filters fit in. If there's ever a chance to have international impact and look at removal of plastic tobacco filters, it's going to be through the output of that intersessional group so that that can feed into the draft text so that when they define the criteria and they list problematic products, that tobacco filters are listed in there, as well as concerns under microplastics, chemicals of concern. So that will be our big focus heading into INC3, and then hopefully to see something in the zero draft copy or influence delegates from whether it's Australia or any other market to actually raise that on our behalf as well as raising it ourselves.
You know, if I look at the waste management hierarchy around plastics, you know, avoiding, reduce, reuse, recycling, treatment, cleanup, is there a particular focus area do you think that the treaty is aiming at? Like, are they focusing more, like, we've obviously talked a lot about, you know, reducing production of single-use plastics, et cetera. Is that a real key focus of the treaty, do you think? Or is it likely to be more about recycling or cleanup or what?
I think there'd be less around cleanup of future. There would be how to deal with legacy waste, which is an important element. The really great thing is that topics like reuse, which weren't naturally considered in this, have actually come to the fore with a couple of countries and also environmental organisations. So reuse all of a sudden becomes part of that. So yes, it's part of the hierarchy, but if this is plastic pollution, then it's a question of, like, what does that mean? And there was all these debates around what's the definition of pollution and what's the definition of plastic pollution. Everything from designing out unnecessary plastics through to restriction of consumption to a sustainable level, reuse becomes part of that discussion. You know, if you can reuse something, you're not producing something new. And then recycling only what you need to. But then this is where some of the countries talk about plastics in a circular economy, creation of jobs. There's talk about waste to energy. There's all these conversations and complexities that start coming into the conversation as well. Everything you mentioned is basically being considered and on the table. It's just a question of what are the priorities and what's the language around those priorities so that when it's executed, people can kind of say, yeah, that's our focus. The good thing is it's considering everything left to right.
And in terms of, I guess, your particular advocacy efforts, and I guess, you know, you focus a lot of, obviously, your attention on, you know, creating a butt-free environment. Is this your key focus area around this global plastic treaty, or are you sort of finding you're having to do a lot more focused, you know, advocacy and education in on a national or state basis, or doing something differently on the global scale?
It's a similar message, which is good. The opportunity that we've got now for the states, which are saying, hey, look, we're really interested. And, you know, obviously this Belgian example is actually a really good, strong case. And we're talking about harmonisation of single-use plastic bans across states in Australia. For me, there's necessity to bring it forward at a state, national and international level at the same timeline. We can't wait till the end of 2024 to find out that the mandate is to implement it by 2039. We can't wait to the end of 2024 to determine that this isn't included or that it won't happen. So I think the call would be for Australian and federal and any government around the world to progress their plans, whether that be plastic tobacco filters or anything else when it comes to single-use plastics, to progress their plans so that we've got national implementation plan that can be scaled up internationally rather than waiting for international action. So I think that they have to happen in parallel, and they'll only be stronger when that happens.
The whole global plastics treaty sounds very promising, and it sounds like in some form there'll be some sort of plastic pollution treaty to reduce plastic production, enhance recycling, increase reuse, focus a little bit on cleanup of legacy pollution. But whatever it looks like, and the details obviously be fine-tuned over the next 18 months, it's coming. Governments can sit on their hands and just wait for it to come out or be proactive. And obviously, like anything, there's going to be advantages to actually be ahead of the game, drive innovation, whether it be technological innovation, education, or other sort of solutions to help address this problem. And there's an opportunity, obviously, for countries to capitalize on potential innovations, like something you've talked about previously is creating, using sort of a sense, is it mycelium to recycle or repurpose cigarette butts? I mean, it's going to be a growing need around something like that. Yeah, it'd make sense to invest heavily now and potentially likely reap the benefits at a later stage.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and part of that is make sure you're building it so it's ready for when they come. In my world, people are like, but that's why you're working out solutions if you're trying to ban it in the first place. And I'm also a pragmatist. I'm a realist. And I want this. And, you know, our initial intention was to make sure it's a butt-free environment. And yes, we could keep collecting, you know, 1,000 a day. But if there's 8.9 billion in the Australian environment, that takes a lot of people a lot of time to actually collect. And by the time we do that, there's another 8.9 billion there. So we've got to stop it upstream. But in the event that I'm not successful, I hate to think that we've accepted that there's still going to be 8.9 billion butts left in the environment. So we need to be looking at ways that we can deal with that should this not be successful or not be implemented for a decade. And that's why I think whether it's, you know, mycelium remediation, whether that's, you know, biochar, whether that's 3D printing, whether that's all of these things which we're investigating as potential streams in a circular economy, they've got to be ready. They've got to be at least tested and proven. And if we don't end up needing to use them, no worries at all. But if we've got all the intelligent people going, you know what, if case A doesn't happen, then case B is ready to go, then absolutely right. You've got your first mover advantage.
Yeah. And obviously there's multiple benefits associated with acting now. I mentioned, you know, from a commercial or innovation perspective. One thing I've noticed in the last few years since we've been talking about plastic pollution is a growing awareness around the climate change impacts associated with plastic pollution. I mean, was that sort of a focus area or a discussion point at the INC2 at all?
Not enough. It was briefly mentioned, but definitely not enough. And I think we in our submission actually made that reference to the triple planetary crisis, you know, being climate change, being biodiversity loss and plastic pollution, and the fact that there is a connection between all three. And I think we talk about plastic production and emissions, end-of-life management and waste fill and incineration and so on leading towards climate change. And there is that direct connection. There's also this connection to biodiversity and the impact of littering plastic in the marine environment, as you would know yourself well too well. So I think those three conversations, those three topics have to be connected. And I hope that countries will take a strong part on that. The other tricky thing is that there are so many of these agreements and treaties and protocols that already exist. And there was some very fair comments by some of the countries saying, like, which one are we supposed to act under here and which one are we supposed to act under here? So there is probably necessity for a framework agreement or something which connects the two so that everyone knows exactly how and when they're supposed to be acting under what protocol. But yeah, absolutely. Climate change is critically important and the connection between the two.
If I can change the conversation back to butts, one of my favorite topics, we mentioned right at the start that obviously there's a decreasing amount of cigarette smoking, but an increasing amount of vaping across the communities. And anyone who's walked outside will see that and attest to it. How has that impacted littering rates? I'm guessing you're seeing a decrease in cigarette butts, but potentially an increase significantly in vaping batteries or cartridges. What are you seeing in the field?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at vaping consumption rates increasing, and we're talking like double every couple of years, so it's gone from 2.5% to 5%, you know, in the last couple of years since the last surveys were done. And that's reported amounts. And we're looking at 14 to 19 year olds. We know that people are younger than that vaping. So the increase in the action of vaping creates the opportunity for an increase in litter. So when we work with, like, for example, you know, Graham and Carolina at Sea Shepherd, they note that vapes are becoming more and more prevalent when they're doing their cleanups. Cleanup Australia noted this year and recorded it as a separate line item because they had noticed themselves. So there's the litter issue. We don't want to see these, you know, littered. So less frequently littered, but more impact when they do. They've got batteries. They've got the toxic chemicals. They contain nicotine, or at least in 90 odd percent of the case, even if they say they don't. They've got copper in the coil there. You've got the plastic or the aluminium in the casing. So we don't want it as a litter stream. But what a lot of people haven't realized that it's a massive issue for landfill as well. If we start looking at the amount of people that are actually vaping and vaping regularly and using disposable vapes, they're actually, I've estimated there's 1 million single-use disposable vapes being landfilled each week. The crazy thing about that means that there's batteries, there's lithium batteries, lithium-ion batteries, depending on the model, which is being thrown in the bin. And then ending up in landfill. Now that's creating fires. It's creating leachate of all these toxic chemicals. And no one's been really prepared for this. And, you know, there's lots of good intention and lots of opportunity to look at the future. But if we look at programs like B-Cycle, which is a fantastic initiative run by Battery Stewardship Council, but they're not equipped to take these batteries. You know, they don't get a levy. They don't get funding to take them. And they're usually integrated and the user can't separate them. And if they do separate them, what do they do with the nicotine part? What do they do with the battery? Council e-waste drop-offs, bulk of them don't accept them. I think Sydney does. There's a couple of isolated ones that say they do, but most either say they don't or they're silent on the topic. So it's created this massive issue and no one actually knows how to deal with it. In Victoria, it's illegal. So vapes are considered e-waste and it's illegal to landfill e-waste. So you can't legally dispose of your vape in Victoria in the bin to end up in landfill, but you also can't stockpile batteries. So the question is, how does a Victorian deal with their vape? And the answer is there is no answer.
I find that staggering. Like I was going to ask you the question with all the naivety in the world, if I'm after I've done with my vape, what am I legally allowed to do with it? And you just answered the question. I guess if I'm in Victoria, there's no legal way of disposing of this product. And you were saying 1 million a week of cartridges or whatever they are being disposed of in landfill in Australia. I mean, that is an enormous, call me naive, and I am naive. How does a product come into our market, be used by what you say 5% of the population? So en masse, there's no real assessment of the health implications to the user, but also no dedicated method or even a legal method of actually handling or managing the waste product that eventuates from its use. How does that happen? Like, and I'm not just sort of focusing on vapes. Like, how does that happen in any way, shape or form for any product?
Let's ignore the fact that it's got nicotine residue and so on. Let's just imagine it's a battery operated product, but it's coming through as a consumer good. It's coming through without a declaration because they're saying that they don't contain nicotine. So it's just coming through as a consumer good, consumer battery operated good, battery operated confectionery. And so therefore, it's not really governed by too much when it comes to that e-waste. So if you've got Big W, you might have, for example, a battery-operated furry toy and you can drop that off into your TerraCycle bin or whatever else. Like, there's a way to deal with most of these waste streams. But when it comes to battery-operated products like, you know, consumable items, the thing is, the question would be, is it the same as an electric toothbrush? Now, obviously, it serves a different purpose. Call it the same size, battery-operated. So why can't it be considered like that? Well, actually, because they come through legitimate methods. There's a levy on the batteries. We know how to target the importers and the regulators. And hey, they don't contain nicotine. imagine sending your battery group out to, you know, open a bag of batteries, and all of a sudden there's a bunch of nicotine juice in that. It's crazy. I think it's been a big miss by all. It's been something I've been very passionate about for about 18 months now. The federal government did call out for consultations for their next range of e-waste. And similarly, WA has also got a strategy open for their waste and e-waste strategy. So there's a few methods that people like ourselves can go about, but that's just raising a voice and asking for something to happen in the future.
But we shouldn't have to. Like, fundamentally, and this gets back to a point I made with Graham Lloyd in our chat recently, like the producers of these items, whether it's a single-use water bottle or a vape or plastic bag, they're making an enormous amount of money producing these products, but having no financial consequence associated with the ultimate disposal of that product. And that's just unacceptable. They're taking all this revenue, and it's fundamentally society and ultimately humanity that are paying for the cost. It seems completely unjust. For me, that has to be, I'm hoping it is, a key element of the plastic treaty that we were talked about before, in that plastic producers need to be held financially accountable for the product that they produce. It seems like such a simple thing. I just want to see that in the treaty. For me, that's rule number one. Is that going to happen, Shannon?
I think, yeah, if we talk about the treaty, I think, you know, that's the intention, is the financial mechanisms that are available to the triggers which are available to, you know, tax it at rates that create an economy so that, you know, there is incentive to use recycled, toxic-free quality, you know, recycled content from the circular economy, subsidized by, you know, what producers are being charged in the first place, so that the consumer doesn't end up having to pay extra to get, you know, a quality recycled product. And at the same time, we're reducing demand for virgin product at the same time. So I think, yes, we will see something like that. It's just a question of to what level, based off, you know, how loud different countries and industry yell. But absolutely, I mean, it's the user may be the one that litters it, but, you know, it doesn't become litter until it becomes consumed, and you can't consume it until you've bought it, and you can't buy it if it's not produced. Like, you've got to follow that trail, and everyone in that value chain has got accountability, and in particular, the producer, absolutely. In this case, though, why hasn't the government regulated, taxed, levied, so that we do actually have way to fund a scheme? How cool would it be to go, yeah, you know what, that's $2 per vape that you're bringing in, and that's going to go to this scheme that already exists. Hey, everyone, this is where it goes. There were some gaps there that I think some of the governments, former, current, need to work on, but absolutely hold the producer accountable. And if the user has to pay a levy or whatever along the way to actually, you know, do that, they're also held accountable for if and when there's litter. There's a power stat which I've been recently using. It's a bit of a cross-section, so we might need to edit it back, but I'm just thinking about people and numbers. When we look at the impacts in particular of cigarette butt pollution, and we look at the percentage of Australians that smoke, right? So there's roughly 10% of Australians that smoke, plus a couple of percent that smoke casually. So let's call it 12. And we know that up to half of the people litter. Let's call it 6. 6% of Australians create the most littered item in the country and in the world, and 100% of Australians pay to clean it up. So when we look at that, that to me is one of the motivating factors for saying we have to solve this, and we either have to solve it through international policy or national policy. And if we can't be banning it, how do we work out how to charge the producers and the polluters so that the average taxpayer doesn't have to pay for that?
Yeah, that is, for me, the key question. I feel as though we could talk all day, Shannon, about this issue, but it's been a wonderful chat once again. I feel as though we obviously need to land this plane, but just to wrap things up, are you involved in the subsequent discussions? And are you going to be bound heading to Korea, hopefully high-fiving a whole bunch of Ukrainians and Brazilians come sometime end of next year?
I think that's on the radar. We seem to have a role to play. Not expecting it to be a big role. I'm not expecting us to influence, you know, overall negotiations or dozens of countries by any means. But I think we have a role, and we're fortunate enough that we've got the opportunity to play that role. So I'd love to be there at Korea when, you know, the pen goes to paper and the countries agree this is the treaty of the age. This is the treaty which will actually solve plastic pollution for our generation and for future generations.
It's a very exciting time, Shannon. In my years of knowing you, you've done such a sterling job about raising attention and awareness and driving real change in this space. And look, I totally take my hat off to you. And all I can say is keep up the amazing work. And I look forward to seeing what you and the collective other 180 nations around the planet can achieve come sometime late next year.
Sounds great. I'll definitely be in touch next year, I'm sure. And maybe Graham and I can jump on together. There's a couple of projects we're cooking along. I think true collaboration actually, you know, has great impact. So be great to let you know and let the audience know what's happening in that space in the future.
Keep me in suspense there, Shannon. Well done. I have to get you on for appearance number 4 sometime very soon. Thank you so much for coming on our show today. Keep up the great work and hopefully catch up in person sometime very soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Brett.
Boom, boom, shake the room.
Thanks for listening to the Ocean Protect podcast. If you'd like to find out more about us and what we do, check us out at oceanprotect.com.au.